In 1974, when I received my first field guide for Christmas, it was like opening the Sears Christmas catalog, what we children called the wish book. A whole big section showed what seemed like every toy in the world. My first field guide was like that, showing so many thrilling possibilities all out there waiting for me. Some of the birds pictured I'd have to travel to see in real life. Ptarmigans, like the ones White Fang encountered in one of my favorite children's books. California condors and Everglade kites that were appearing on posters supporting the Endangered Species Act. And puffins and roseate spoonbills, which looked too impossibly bizarre to be real. But according to the range maps, some of the coolest-looking birds could be found right near me. Common loons, ruby-throated hummingbirds, blackburnie and warblers, pileated woodpeckers. And now I could imagine seeing them in real life. That field guide gave me the tools to identify birds, but much more important, it issued both an invitation and a personal mandate to go out and look for them. That little book was my very own passport to adventure. During my first year of birding, I did manage to find in the field guide most of the birds I saw. I quickly learned that the challenge of identifying each bird could be both enjoyable and rewarding. But more importantly, I learned that the identifications were hardly ever the most enjoyable or rewarding elements of a day with birds. Indeed, sometimes it felt more rewarding to just stop and look at them without teasing out identifications. One of the most pleasurable days of my first year of birding was spent in a railroad yard watching pigeons, seeing their muscular wings in action, drinking in their noisy takeoffs and powerful wing beats in direct flight, and thrilling at how they hold those wings in a steep V as they rock slightly back and forth in soaring flight. It was a wondrously satisfying 3 or 4 hours that I still remember with a smile. Knowing the names of things is a primal urge for our species, referenced as long ago as Genesis, with Adam naming all the beasts and all the fowls of the air. Children quickly need a much more precise word than dinosaur for Stegosaurus, Brontosaurus, and Tyrannosaurus rex. If I tell you a story about a bird and want you to be able to picture it the way it looks to me, calling it a brilliant red bird with black wings might not give you a picture of the scarlet tanager, Hawaiian eevee, or vermilion flycatcher I was trying to describe. The precise vividness of a name can be valuable. You can, of course, take the precision of bird identification too far. About birds, Walt Whitman wrote, "Many I cannot name, but I do not particularly seek information. You must not know too much or be too precise or scientific about birds and trees and flowers and watercraft. A certain free margin and even vagueness, perhaps ignorance, credulity, helps your enjoyment of these things." Even if you don't usually want to go beyond Whitman's free margin, a good field guide can inspire you to go a-lookin' for those birds and trees and flowers. My three favorite bird field guides are the National Geographic, if you want the most comprehensive guide, the Kaufman Field Guide to Birds of North America, if you want a comprehensive North American guide that uses photos and is the one kids usually like best, and the ABA State Field Guides, if you want a pretty comprehensive guide to just one state. I happen to have written the Minnesota one. But just as Walt Whitman bundled birds with trees and flowers, when we go out looking for birds, we see a lot of other elements of nature. One field guide is perfect for even the most advanced birder who notices other things out there as well. Tomorrow, I'll tell you about the Kaufman Field Guide to Nature of the Midwest. I'm Laura Erickson, speaking for the birds.